From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Michael Weisskopf was on assignment in Baghdad for Time magazine, traveling in the back of an open Humvee when a live grenade landed next to him. He reflexively picked up the grenade and tossed it out of the vehicle. It exploded and blew off his hand. On today's Fresh Air, Weisskopf tells us the story of his injury and his recovery at Walter Reed Army Medical Center's Ward 57, which is reserved for amputees. He's written a new book called Blood Brothers. Also, as parts of the West have become more secular, Africa, Asia, and Latin America have become more Christian, and Christianity is changing in ways that many Westerners are not aware of. We'll talk with Philip Jenkins, author of The New Faces of Christianity. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. While reporting on soldiers in Iraq, my guest Michael Weisskopf was injured like a soldier. He lost a hand, tossing out a live grenade that had been thrown into his Humvee. Weisskopf is a senior correspondent for Time magazine and was embedded with the 1st Armored Division that operated in a district of northwest Baghdad. It was December 2003, and he was doing the research for Time's Person of the Year story, profiling the American soldier as the Person of the Year. Now Weisskopf has written a new book called Blood Brothers about his injury and his treatment at Walter Reed Medical Center's Ward 57, the wing of the military hospital reserved for amputees. His book also profiles several soldiers who were treated in the ward. You may have seen Weisskopf on the cover of last week's Time magazine holding out the hook which has replaced his right hand. I asked him to describe how he lost his hand.
I was driving in a open-air Humvee with two soldiers and a photographer for Time magazine named James Noctway. And suddenly, after we were emerging from a marketplace, I heard a thud. I looked down to my right on a bench I was sitting on, and this was an open-air Humvee, almost like a pickup truck with a cab in the front of it. And I looked down, and I saw something unrecognizable to me. It was dark and shiny like the back of a tortoise shell. I leaned over, picked it up, and it was so hot I could feel my hand liquefying. And at that point, I arched my back and attempted to toss it sort of backhand as one would a tennis ball over the net. And suddenly everything went dark.
When did you realize your hand had been blown off and that that was a grenade?
I woke up seconds later in the cold bed of the Humvee, and I was quite disoriented. And for a minute, I thought I was having a nightmare and noticed that my right arm was numb, almost as if it had been when I would sleep on it. And as I do in those moments, I shook my arm to sort of wake it up, and nothing happened. Raised it to look at it, and there it was, without a hand on it. Didn't look much different than sort of the decapitated head of a chicken with blood gushing and tendons showing.
What was your emotional reaction to seeing your stump?
I was dazed. Worried, more worried, I think, by the profusion of blood coming out. I was very weak. My heart was pinging in my chest, kind of wanly. And I thought that given where I was, which was on the bed of a Humvee in the middle of a tough neighborhood in Baghdad, not known for great emergency rooms, that my life was ending. And it occurred to me that this was a pretty unglamorous place to be ending my life, and I thought of my son, Skyler, who was then 11, the same age I was when my father died, and I had a tremendous sense of loss and guilt that I would be doing to him what my father had done to me, which is leaving the scene at a critical time.
How did your father die?
My father died of a heart attack. He was 36 years old, 1957. I was 11 years old.
So who rescued you that day?
A medic in a Humvee behind me. We were in a 3 Humvee convoy. Noticed when I lifted my right arm that there was no hand on it, and it was gushing blood. And her name was Billy Grimes. She was a specialist then from a small town in Indiana. And she dashed from her Humvee, threw it in park, she was the driver, and ran and dodged bullets, actually, to get to my Humvee and sort of catapulted herself over the back of it and got in and had a hard time gaining footing because of the blood, not only from me, but from Jim Noctway, the photographer, and a couple of soldiers who were in the back of the Humvee with me. And she pulled a a cord from her belt, the kind of cord that's usually used to tighten one's arm when they're taking blood pressure. And she used it as a tourniquet to shut off the blood, and making it quite tight, and then wound a field dressing around that for good measure.
What happened to the other people in your Humvee?
All three of them in the open-air cargo area I was in were severely injured initially, and they have recovered to varying degrees. Jim Noctway, the photographer, still has some metal in his knees, which limits his mobility as a photographer, but he is back at work and doing great. Of the two soldiers, both of whom received Purple Hearts, one of them is retired. He had a couple fractures to his femur. The other one had injuries to his knees and hands and remained in the service.
Oh, one of the first things that you had to do was get your stump shortened so that you could get a better prosthetic. Why did you need to have this other surgery to shorten your stump?
First of all, it was a shock to me that I needed to have another amputation. After all, I had gone through one involuntarily, and I was asked if I wanted to lose a couple more inches of my bone, of my arm, in order to do that. And the reason is that in the state-of-the-art myoelectric arms, you can now rotate the wrist. That means turning 360 degrees to the right and the left, and that it was said to provide certain advantages. And I was given that as an option, whether or not I wanted to lose that couple extra inches. And the reason I needed to lose it is that for that capability, you had to add about an inch and a half cartridge into the shell of an arm that's known as a prosthesis. And that if I had an arm that was, if I had a stump that was longer, the prosthesis itself would hang much lower toward my knees, and the object was to try to have arm lengths of the same size.
Would you describe that myoelectric hand that that you were fitted with?
Yes, and it looks shiny and bionic, but it's actually been around for some time in various incarnations. The way it operates is the muscles, when they are flexed, give off tiny electrical signals, and they lie on top of an electrode inside of this shell, this kind of plastic shell you wear over your stump. And the electrodes then send little signals to computer in a hand, and it makes the hand, mechanical hand or hook, open and close or turn depending upon what you've got. That's the process. It's a Greek word. Myo is a Greek word for muscle, and of course electric means just electric.
Now, at first you had like, correct me if I'm wrong here, at first you had like a high-tech hand, but you opted instead for a hook.
Right.
Why did you prefer the hook to the hand?
Well, it wasn't so much really a question of the mechanical hand itself for a hook. It was really the question of what that mechanical hand looked like. And it was covered in a very fine, spongy silicone that really imitated life. It was sculpted and done by an artist with coloration and texture just like a real hand. And I found it on a couple levels. It made me unhappy. First, it was dead. It was, although it looked like my real hand, it was frozen in a kind of claw-like position, and it reminded me of death, not life. And I felt that I wanted to remind myself of how fortunate I was to be still living. It also wasn't very functional. Because it was kind of spongy and silicone, knives slipped out of it. If I was trying to cut a steak, for instance, it was difficult to hold things, difficult to pick things up. Finally, it kind of disguised my wound, and over time, I became increasingly proud of losing my hand. For the end I achieved with it. And so I felt that there was no point in trying to disguise it. When I started losing my hair, I didn't get a toupee or hair plugs or try a comb over. I just cut all my hair off and had a sort of a bald cut. And I felt the same way eventually about my wound, that it was something I didn't want to hide. And so I went to a silver hook, which there was no way of camouflaging my wound at that point. It's much more functional, not quite as fast as a mechanical hand, which is driven by a new computer, but it really was what it was. It held things well, picked up things well.
My guest is Time Magazine senior correspondent Michael Weisskopf. His new book is called Blood Brothers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Weisskopf. He's a senior correspondent for Time Magazine. His new book, Blood Brothers, is a memoir about what happened to him when his hand was blown off by a grenade while covering the war in Iraq. He was doing a Person of the Year story, and the Person of the Year was the American soldier in Iraq. And the book is also about other soldiers who lost limbs in Iraq. Are you still in pain? I know that phantom pain is a typical problem after amputations. I'm not sure if that lasts forever or only a certain amount of time.
Phantom pain is something that is pretty individualistic. In my case, it continues. For others, it's more severe than me, and still others don't have any pain at all. It's an odd sensation, hard for non-amputees to understand, because the pain is in an extremity you lost, and it's been around since the Civil War, when many soldiers were treated simply by having their limbs sawed off if they had an injury to their limbs, and very little is known about it. It operates neurologically, and because it's so mysterious, there really is no known cure for it.
I know when I'm in pain, I keep thinking this is a sign of something terrible that might get even worse. One of the differences between phantom pain and other pain is that other pain is a warning of something that is going wrong, that needs your attention, whereas with phantom pain, it already went wrong. And it's kind of like too late to do anything about it. So everybody speaks of, that kind of pain as being an alarm that you try to turn off because it's not signaling anything that you can do anything about. Does it help deal with that pain, knowing that it's not warning you of a problem? The problem's already done.
Well, in a sense, you're reminded of, through the pain, of the incident itself, because my phantom pain, and that of many people with upper extremity wounds, feels a lot like it felt when I picked up that hot grenade and when the thing went off just as it left my hand. My hand it feels like a burning and a squeezing, like one of those uncles you used to have who would crunch your knuckles when he shook your hand. And you want to shake it you wanted to do something internally to make it feel better, squeeze it yourself and rub it yourself or something, but nothing makes it go away. I've tried acupuncture, I've tried medication, I've tried electric stimulus, hypnosis, various things, and it's just a very hard thing to shake.
You were treated in a military hospital surrounded by soldiers who had had, injuries of every sort. And my long-distance sense of this is that a lot of soldiers really know how to deal with injury and pain, and I don't know whether that's just their orientation or their training, but did you feel like you were learning from them how to deal with pain and how to deal with loss.
Yes, and for them, of course, this was a big price for a just cause, and it helped them in a different kind of way than me. They believe in kind of a nobility of sacrifice and see their wounds as part of the cost of that. It was a heroic view of injury and something I was able to learn from them, although I brought to it a much different calculus. I wasn't there to fight a war. I was there to report on a war. And I didn't enlist in the military in order to defend it militarily, defend the country militarily. I was there just to observe for readers. And so I brought something different to it, but watching them made it easier for me and gave me some courage, particularly the guys I wrote about. Their struggles were epic and really stiffened my backbone.
The doctors and physical therapists at an Army hospital like Walter Reed are probably in a way unfazed by extreme injuries and the pain that results from them because they see it all the time. Was that helpful for you to have doctors and physical therapists who weren't that impressed by your injury, or did you want more sympathy than that?
No, I liked the fact that my injury to them was routine because, after all, in our civilian society, amputations are rare and really frightening. We see very few people missing limbs, particularly in urban centers. They do exist in agricultural areas and meatpacking cities and towns where there's, for instance, a timber industry. But in my life, it was rare. It was pretty rare. I would see returnees from, say, World War II with their pants legs buttoned up or their arms. Their arm sleeves pinned up at baseball games, for instance, as a kid, and I had a friend who lost a leg and when he was hit by a car, but it was a very rare circumstance, and so it was a scary prospect for me, and the fact that professional people saw it all the time and were unfazed by it, I think, gave me a certain amount of security and well-being at the start.
You know, you write in your book that you wanted to be known for your reporting, not for your soldiering. How did being embedded and losing a hand in the process affect your view of embedding as a form of war journalism?
Yeah, I was drawn into it like every journalist with eagerness because we all want to be as close as possible to our subjects. And after all, I was writing about the American soldier and living with them and working with them provided that amazing type of access. But I realized after the injury that the costs of that access, were even larger than my injury. And certainly exposing yourself to danger. And every time I got into a Humvee, I put myself in the crosshairs with really the targets of insurgents. And it wasn't smart because in the end, a reporter is no better than his story, and if you're injured or killed, of course, you don't tell a story. But more importantly than that, you sacrifice your independence. If you are fed and protected and housed by a group of guys, you really are not in a position to report on them objectively, particularly if it's over a period of time. If it's 48 hours or something, it's one thing. But to engage in this for a month's time, and I was in the fourth week of that, you really do surrender quite a bit. And more importantly, my job there was to write about the American soldier in December of 2003 when that insurgency was really starting to get its legs. And part of that story was reporting on the unpopularity of American troops in Baghdad and the rest of Iraq for that purpose. And I wasn't really able to do that from the seat of an Army Humvee. I couldn't jump out of my Humvee and walk into a room full of bad guys and say, what do you think of the Americans there? Obviously, I was part of that entourage, of the Army entourage. And I might as well have been slinging an M16. There was no doubt that I was considered one of them, and I was injured like one of them. So in a way it's a bit of a snare, and we don't really do what we should for a reader when we are that kind of deeply engaged and enmeshed with an army group. You lose the kind of edge and objectivity you should bring into it as a reporter.
Michael Weisskopf is a senior correspondent for Time magazine. His new book is called Blood Brothers, Among the Soldiers of Ward 57. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Two-thirds of the world's Roman Catholics live in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Coming up, the growth of Christianity in the global South and how it's changing Christianity. And we'll continue our conversation with Michael Weisskopf, who lost a hand while covering the war in Baghdad for Time magazine. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Weisskopf, a senior correspondent for Time magazine. In December 2003, he was embedded with the 1st Armored Division in Iraq, reporting on the American soldier, which Time had chosen as the person of the year. When a grenade landed in his Humvee, he reflexively tossed it out. By doing that, he probably saved the lives of everyone in the vehicle, but he lost his right hand. His new book, Blood Brothers, is about his injury and his treatment at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He also profiles several soldiers who lost limbs in the war. When you had your hand blown off by the grenade in Iraq, Fresh Air was among the many places that asked about an interview with you, and you write in your book, you explain that you refused interviews for a long time, in part because you couldn't honestly characterize what motivated you to throw the grenade out of the Humvee, and you weren't sure whether you were a hero or a fraud, or if what you did was stupid. Can you talk about some of those doubts that you were having then?
Well, it started out really from the start when I was in the combat support hospital in Baghdad. And after awakening in the hospital, a nurse came up to me and said, "You're a hero for saving people in that Humvee." And I was still in shock and wasn't thinking it through and felt that I was crazy to have engaged in that kind of military activity, since I really wasn't trained for it. And if I hadn't, I wouldn't have lost my hand. Of course, I wasn't thinking straight. But that was the beginning of many characterizations of my actions as heroic. And because I did it as sort of a reflex, I didn't calculate the consequences before doing it. I was wont to accept that kind of label as a hero. I felt that heroes in my book made a conscious decision to sacrifice themselves for the better good, and that I hadn't made that type of calculation before I acted. And I resisted and felt sort of embarrassed by that label, and particularly because after the injury itself, many people wanted to sort of put me on their shoulders and thank me. I kind of avoided any type of press coverage.
Well, before the grenade exploded, before you picked it up and felt how hot it was, did you have any idea that it was a grenade?
This was part of really my kind of reanalysis. I wasn't quite sure what it was that motivated me to pick it up, even. As I recall later on, and I kind of jogged myself to over a period of almost 18 months, I remembered that the group I was out with was frequently pelted by rocks thrown by some of the kids, who greeted us with cheers until we turned our backs, and then threw rocks at the Humvees. And the soldiers would often pick them up as like Mardi Gras trinkets and keep them, and sort of like souvenirs. And I wasn't sure if I had acted, you know, that way, or if I had picked it up because I spotted danger. And I had a dream about it, and in the dream, I was put back in the Humvee, and recalled the whole incident in the dream, and saw smoke coming off of this object in the Humvee. And I awakened and thought, well, that explains a lot. If I had seen smoke coming out of the grenade, I must have recognized its danger and grabbed it for that purpose. But then I wasn't sure if I was conning myself in the dream. I wasn't sure if this was a delusion in order to kind of justify the nice things people were saying about me. And so this went on for some time.
Let me tell you my reaction to reading this part of your book, where you're wondering, is it proper to describe you as a hero if what you did was purely a reflex as opposed to a calculation? I always worry about myself that if I were in a situation like yours, I would be sitting there analyzing the pros and cons, like, what is this? Should I throw it out? Should it be, and I'd be just kind of like overthinking it. And reflexes are so important. I always wonder if I have any. But the fact that yours just worked and you automatically did the right thing, isn't that a good thing? I mean, isn't that something that you should be really relieved about and should give you confidence about how you function?
Yes, the truth, that is the answer in short. And, I learned later on to be proud of those kind of reflexes. And that goes to the fact that I was eager to no longer disguise my wound in terms of the that silicone lifelike hand, that I felt like I had earned, in other words, my wound and I was more proud of it, and I felt that it at least reflected a few seconds of honorable action on my part. And military people think about this all the time. What would they do if they were confronted by that kind of danger, and in the midst of their men, in the midst of their colleagues? And I wasn't trained that way, and so it made me still question whether I deserved that kind of a label. And I had to work it through for some time to decide that I had acted honorably.
If you hadn't thrown the grenade out of the Humvee, what would have happened?
Well, certainly we would have all died. My hand, the fact that I hoisted it, and my hand was close to it and absorbed much of the blast, saved me and everyone else in the Humvee. There were a couple of guys also in the cab, so in all there were six of us, and we may all have died if it was left there, and there's no question about that. And that's what that nurse in Baghdad pointed out immediately. If I hadn't picked up that Humvee, we would have all died. And because I was so stunned by what happened, it was even hard for me to grasp that logic at first.
You know, we mentioned earlier the cover of Time magazine, the picture of you with your hook, and this was the recent edition in which your book was excerpted. There's another picture in Time, in which in your hook you were holding the blood-stained pad, reporter's notebook that you had when your hand was blown off. What have you done with that book? Where do you keep it?
I keep it close to me at work. More importantly, I keep a photograph, which Jim Noctway took of me on the bed of the Humvee with my amputated arm in the air. He is a remarkable photographer, as I said, and shot them even after he was injured himself as he was going down and got off a couple frames. No one has seen that picture, and publicly, that is. It's just a handful of people, including, of course, the photographer and me and family members. And I keep it on a bulletin board next to my computer in my workspace as kind of a reminder of humility and how in a matter of seconds, life can shift, and you can lose it, and just how fragile life is, and how easy it is to lose it.
You know, the moment of impact in any kind of accident is exactly the thing that many people forget. Because they lose consciousness right afterwards, and they're glad that they forget to keep a photo of that moment of impact so close to you all the time. How come it's not upsetting to see it?
It is upsetting, and that's the idea. It reminds me of life's fragility and how every moment counts.
Right. I figured you had a reminder of that attached to your arm.
I do as well, but you know, the more reminders, the better, something like that.
Yeah.
And it's we all go through life with a certain invincibility, and some of us end up with illnesses which have a countdown involved, and you go through a similar process. In my case, I escaped death really just because of good fortune and the skill of a medic and the proximity of medical help, but many others don't, and it's possible to forget that unless you've got reminders.
Michael Weisskopf, I really appreciate you talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Weisskopf is a senior correspondent for Time magazine. His new book is called Blood Brothers. Coming up, how the growth of Christianity in the global South is leading Christianity in a largely more conservative direction. This is Fresh Air. 2/3 of the world's Roman Catholics live in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The Anglican Communion, which the American Episcopal Church is part of, is becoming more African-dominated. The Nigerian branch will soon be its largest representative. The spread of Christianity in the Global South is moving Christianity in largely more conservative directions and is changing Christianity in ways that most North Americans and Europeans are unaware of. My guest, Philip Jenkins, is the author of the new book, The New Faces of Christianity, Believing the Bible in the Global South. It's a follow-up to his book, The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity. Jenkins is a distinguished professor of history and religious studies at Pennsylvania State University. He says that Christianity's growth in the Global South is connected to population growth, but he thinks it's also connected to the fact that many Africans and Asians relate to the Bible because it portrays a world they can recognize. What are some of the connections that you see between life the way it's described in the Bible and life the way it's lived now in Africa?
Some people have said that if you look at African Christianity, the greatest temptation and the greatest danger is that it is just so easy for people to identify with the Old Testament world. Even if people live in cities, they're familiar with communities around them which are nomadic, which practice polygamy, which still practice blood sacrifice, for example, which sacrifice animals as a normal part of everyday rituals. And when you know this world as something that is around you, it makes it much easier to understand the moral codes that are preached in the Old Testament. Many Christians I know believe thoroughly in the doctrine of atonement, which is a sacrificial doctrine. I'm sometimes tempted to ask my evangelical friends, when they talk about sacrifice and atonement, have they ever seen a sacrifice? Have they ever smelt a sacrifice? And for many Africans, the answer is yes. They don't need to be taught these basic ideas of atonement. They're all around them. The New Testament world also has its own kind of appeal. It's written above all for a world that is characterized by poverty, by hunger, by endemic sickness. And it's when you look at the Bible through African eyes, through many Asian eyes, that you realize these things, and in some cases you tend to see them for the first time. You realize just how much of the Bible is about food and hunger, just how much of the Bible is about perpetual sickness and the need for healing. And when people read a very familiar world, which is almost a documentary, if you like, and then they see the figure of Jesus, who is able to overcome the evils that they face in this world, that is a very powerful message.
Are there different stories within the Bible that are emphasized in countries in the Global South compared to the stories that are emphasized in the West?
There are whole genres, there are whole styles of literature which I think alienate or leave cold people in the Global North that have an immense appeal in some Global South communities. For example, the most devoted American Bible reader tends to glaze over when he or she reads all the genealogies, so-and-so begat so-and-so. There are many tribal communities in Africa or Asia where this is part. This is among the most exciting part of the Bible, because how do you understand who somebody is unless you know where they come from? A genealogy like this shows God's intimate care for his people. Well, that's an extreme example. But some of the passages, some of the stories that carry enormous weight in the Global South, one of them is in the Epistle of James. The Epistle of James is not a particularly well-known or popular book in Global North Christianity. In the Global South, it's one of the most popular sources of sermon texts for one simple idea. The book is about the transience of life. It tells people that their life is a vapor, a mist. You don't know where you will be tomorrow. You can't say that you will be alive tomorrow. And you think about reading that in a community in Africa where the average age of death is 35. That's a, that's a powerful, literal comment. Interestingly, the appeal of James runs across denominations. I was recently reading a commentary on James by none other than the Dalai Lama, who thought that it preached excellent Buddhist truths as well as Christian truths. So I think by looking at the way people read the book in the Global South, we in the North can see whole parts of the Bible that maybe we've forgotten.
Well, you also talk about an emphasis on the supernatural and Christianity as it's practiced in much of the Global South.
Right. Not long ago, Jim Wallace made a very interesting point, which is he said, if you take references to the poor out of the Bible, you don't have much left. And he's absolutely right. But if you take references to angels, demons, exorcisms, and healings out of the Bible, once again, you're left with a pretty slim pamphlet. I think for many Bible readers in the Global North, stories of healings and exorcisms are almost an embarrassment. In Africa or Asia, these are seen as absolutely fundamental. They are a core part of the Christian message, just as they were in the first two or three centuries of Christianity. And you can look at this in different ways. I mean, you can, I suppose, see it as an example of, if you like, a superstitious mindset. But I would rather see it as an expression of power and of the democratization of power. Power is available to anyone, even if they don't possess the right spiritual credentials. If the people who can claim the power to exercise and heal are women and the young, then so be it. And very often they are. If you live in a world that is beset with fears of supernatural forces, and Christianity gives you a means of knowing that you are in control of those forces, they need no longer frighten you, that again is a very powerful cultural, intellectual message.
Are there ways in which the view of Jesus and the view of the devil are very different in churches in the Global South than in the Global North? I know we're making big generalizations here,
sure.
But I guess in some level you kind of have to if you're talking about such a large group of churches.
When you look at the visions of Jesus that we have in the Global North, it's only gradually that you realize how many of them are culturally conditioned, because Christianity grew up in a Greek world, a Roman world, a medieval European world. And that's exactly what Africans and Asians are doing today. They are placing Jesus in contexts that make sense in those particular cultures. A couple of examples, for instance, in Africa, one of the very powerful ideas is Jesus as the great ancestor. In a society in which ancestors are all, in which what ancestors do still affects you, the idea that Jesus is the most powerful ancestor of all, and can, you know, scatter any curses or inheritances like that that have been left, is, again, powerful. And a word I'm going to use again and again, it's liberating. The other key one is Jesus as healer. Global South Christianity succeeds because, above all, it is a healing religion. It is a religion that people seek healing, not just in the sense of healing of the body. You know, I very much doubt if many people can produce film of faith healers healing broken legs, but healing of the problems of the spirit, the soul. South American Pentecostal churches, for example, healing very often means healing from substance abuse in the context of the church and the community. If you want to think of that as therapy rather than healing, fine. These are different words for the same thing.
Are most of the Christians in the Global South evangelical Christians?
A lot of northern world labels don't make very good sense in the Global South. I've certainly had the experience of asking a Nigerian Anglican, where you get very frustrated trying to pin them down and say, look, are you evangelical or Catholic or charismatic? And they will smile and say, yes. At terms like evangelical, don't work very well. In northern world terms, in terms of, if you like, a literal interpretation of the Bible, yes, they're evangelical, but that label also extends to, for instance, many Catholics. You find charismatic ideas across the board. So the denominational labels we have in the North don't work quite so well.
My guest is Philip Jenkins, author of the new book, The New Faces of Christianity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Jenkins, the author of the new book, The New Faces of Christianity. It's about how the expansion of Christianity in the global South is changing Christianity. Given the increase in the size of the Catholic population in the global South, do you see a time, perhaps sometime in the near future, when the Pope would come from a country in the global South? And if so, how do you think that might change the church?
If you look at the numbers within the Catholic Church, it is overwhelmingly likely not just that the next pope will be from the global South, but that most popes for the foreseeable future will be from the global South. Just to put this in perspective, already today, two-thirds of Roman Catholics are from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and that does not count people from those continents living in the global north. It does not count, for example, Mexican Americans. By the time you get to 2050, something like 80% of the world's Catholics will be global south. John Paul II appointed a great many cardinals from, especially from Latin America and Africa, but even so, after all his efforts, those cardinals are still very underrepresented. I think it is more than likely that, I suppose, the future of the church's leadership will be a Latin American and African leadership. Increasingly, as the church becomes a southern church, so the issues that matter in the south come to be the central issues. I think in the short to middle term, a church could be more conservative on sexual issues, issues of sexual preference. But also, I think it could be more progressive on social, economic issues, issues of poverty, world debt, and so on. So I think it could be a mixed message. I say again and again, it's so important not to apply a simple northern world liberal-conservative divide. Somebody can be very conservative on some issues, very liberal on others.
From the travels that you've made through the global South, can you tell us one of the most interesting visits you've had to a church that kind of represents how different some services are there compared to what you might see in the United States where you live?
I'm going to duck around that question a little bit, and I'm going to tell you what is one of my favorite stories, which is not mine, but is a story from a friend, which is one of the best indications I know, which is I was once talking to an Adventist pastor who was an American who was describing visiting a church in South Africa where you had this vast congregation crammed into this tiny hall. And as he walked in, people were very surprised to see a white face in this room, where, in an area where white people were not normally very visible. And gradually people talked to him and found out that he was a pastor, and this was an ordained pastor, and this was a wonderful thing. And the word went up to the platform where the clergyman conducting the service said, "Oh, my friends, I have wonderful news for you. Pastor Smith has come to us all the way from the United States to visit us, and I'm going to ask him to conduct tonight's exorcism." And I sometimes tell that story when I'm speaking to church or seminary audiences, and you can see people turn pale as they imagine how they'd cope with the situation.
What did Pastor Smith do?
Based on his knowledge of films about exorcism, he apparently did very creditably.
So I guess that's an example of how exorcism is widely practiced in the global South?
Of course. But it's not just widely practiced, but it's standard, which is a church which does not carry out exorcisms really has to come up with a good reason for it. And, you know, this is a situation you get with Catholic churches, for example. Catholic churches have to produce all these manuals and guides for how priests are to cope when somebody comes to them complaining that they're possessed. What do they do? How do they cope with pleas for healing, for exorcism? And what they have to do is draw on the church's resources without making what they regard as too great concessions to superstition. But as I sometimes say, if you are not prepared to deal with issues of healing and exorcism, and you're considering a career in religion in Africa, then consider a different career.
Well, Philip Jenkins, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Philip Jenkins is the author of the new book, The New Faces of Christianity. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls, featuring Isabel Bigley, who played the missionary Sister Sarah. Bigley died Saturday at the age of 80.
Ask me how do I feel. Ask me now that we're cozy and clinging. Well, sir, all I can say is if I were a bell, I'd be ringing. From the moment we kissed tonight, that's the way I've just got to
support
be
for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral specializations online at capella.edu. From the Mark G. and Bernie D.L. Strom Foundation for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. And from BMW, utilizing run-flat tires designed for safe handling while driving on a punctured tire. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bob Woodward about his headline-making book, State of Denial, his third and most critical book about the Bush administration. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.